Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Trust, Billboard's co-director of charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
In New York, this is our second podcast of the week, a special emergency podcast we did on Tuesday. Camila Cabello, our special guest, because she's number one on the Hot 100 this week for the first time with Havana.
Yeah, so hopefully all the Camilizers out there enjoyed that one. So for her to be there, on reveal day, and obviously she was really excited, and you could tell just how genuine she was about that. Also, another piece of news in there was that her next song, Never Be the Same, hit the top 40. She almost dropped the phone.
You told her that. You broke the news to her.
I know. And she almost seemed more excited about that. Like, she literally, like she said, almost dropped the phone.
Camila Cabello, our special guest on Tuesday's podcast, back with another one today. Focusing on the Grammy Awards, we have Paul Grine coming up here on the podcast, founder of the Billboard Chartbeat column back in Billboard Magazine 1981. Huge Grammy fan. He's been following the Grammys for years. So we're going to get his takes on some of the biggest categories, give some of our opinions too, talk about some possible snubs this year, just get into all things Grammys coming up with Paul Grine. We'll talk more about the Billboard Hot 100 coming up. And what's our flashback, Trevor?
We are going to take a trip back to 1973. That'll kick us off. Speaking of Grammy Awards, we'll talk about a song that went to number one this week back then that kicked off one of the great Grammy runs of all time.
Right now, this week's top 10 for number 10 to number one on the Billboard Hot 100.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, one.
Number 10.
Put that thing in sports. Shout it bad. Pop it like a court. Pop it. You a dork. Never been a sport. Pull up. Jumping out the
court. Number 9.
It's sad but it's true. I'm way too good at goodbye.
I'm way too good at goodbye.
I'm way too good at goodbye.
Number 8. Number 7.
Soldier, ay, always lit, yeah, I'm never sober. It's for 3 days in a row, y'all bitch coming over. Told that bitch to kick rock, she act like it's a boulder. Hey, Rory, shopping, that mean.
Number 6.
Lightning and the thunder.
Number
5.
Can't blame me for trying. You know I'd be lying, saying you're the one.
Number 4.
It don't make no sense. I hear tripping infamous. You know it, you know it. Fellas, grab your ladies if your lady fine.
Number 3.
These men, I feel just like a rock star. All my brothers got that gas and they always be smoking like a rock star. Fucking with
call up on no Uzi.
I whispered underneath my breath that you heard it. Darling, you look perfect tonight.
And number one.
Look at that. We did not lie to you. There it is, bringing us out a brand new tune at number one, Havana by Camila Cabello featuring Young Thug. I say brand new tune when it's really anything but. The song has been on the Hot 100 for 23 weeks. So it took 23 weeks to get to the number one spot. And if you're wondering, that seems like a long time. That's almost 6 months. Yeah, it is a long time. And it actually ties a record for the longest wait to get to number one by a female artist. In taking 23 weeks, it ties Sia's Cheap Thrills with Sean Paul, which hit number one back in late summer of 2016. And then before that, you got to flip the books back all the way to the 80s. We're talking about Patty Austin. If any of the young bloods know who Patty Austin is out there, her song with James Ingram, Baby Come to Me, very 80s. Appropriate.
So all three songs with a male artist as well. Okay. Interesting progression. You go from the 80s where it was a singer, James Ingram, Sean Paul, rapper, singer, reggae, and now Young Thug, rapper.
Sean Paul's a man of many talents, Jack of all trades.
And you talk about such an 80s song. I'm sure that was on one of the... you're probably too young to... Do you remember those TV commercials where they would have compilations of 80s love songs?
Well, I remember, there's the 80s, 90s versions where it's scroll up, like, all, right. It's
Air Supply, all
Luther
these other...
and Celine, and every six or seven, then they, change the song out.
That feels like a song that was perfect. I'm sure it was in a lot of those commercials.
I am, 100%. So Camila ties that, and I know for a lot of people, and I guess I have to kind of raise my hand here as well, some people thought this day might not come. Havana had been number two on Hot 100 for 5 weeks. At the end of last year, stuck behind Post Malone's Rockstar and Ed Sheeran's Perfect. It had dipped down to number three for a little bit, got back to that number two spot for the last 2 weeks. So 7 weeks overall at number two. Finally, it has enough momentum behind it. Really a big streaming gain this week that powers it to the top spot.
The album came out. Camila debuts at number one on the Billboard 200. So much buzz in the tracking week helped the profile for Havana. The song was on sale too in iTunes for 69 cents. So it had a good sales gain. Airplay is still big. It's number two in airplay. It's number one in streaming. So the combination of Perfect has started to come down just enough. Havana held on just long enough. And then with the album coming out, gave it that boost that, I think you're absolutely right. It was starting to look like maybe it's just not going to happen. It's going to be one of those long running, 7 week number two songs. But the buzz of the album helped do it.
Well, particularly felt like, sometimes there've been cases where a song is kind of blocked by one song at number one. This one's kind of interesting because two songs really had done it in.
Right.
When Post Malone was number one and you felt like it was going to be that kind of 1-2 combo for a while, and then Ed Sheeran's Perfect had leapfrogged it. And at that point it seemed like, if you're going to get blocked on, by two different songs, then it really feels like there's no way you're going to be the third number one of that. But hey, she made it.
It was Beyonce kind of kept Camila from maybe going to number one. The remix came out and that helped push Perfect to number one.
I guess is Camila throwing away Lemonade and Sasha Fierce and all those things now?
Yeah, you look back over the Hot 100's history, won't mention every song, but there's been so many number two hits that feel kind of like they're on that level of a number one hit and just kept out for various reasons, timing. Some of the most recent number two hits before... Well, now Havana isn't on that group, but Wild Thoughts by DJ Khaled featuring Rihanna and Bryson Tiller hit number two. Zayn, Taylor Swift, I Don't Want to Live Forever. They were the last two number two hits both last year. But yeah, I'm not sure those necessarily feel like number one hits. The last one I go back to that really feels like it was a number one hit, although it peaked at number two. Again, this is all subjective, but doesn't Hotline Bling by Drake feel like a number one hit? Yeah.
You used to call me on my cell phone late night when you need my
Yeah. Yeah, I think it does. I mean, especially just how big the video was and how much that really pushed it. And it's one of those things that was a song that had a pretty good ride. I mean, it came out, you know, basically in the spring, summer of that year. It kind of just cruised through as all things Drake, just streamed and just rode the wave. And then the video comes out, of course, and that becomes this sort of meme pop culture phenomenon that gets parodied left, right, and center. So, yeah, I mean, as ubiquitous as that song was for such a long time, you're right. I mean, it feels weird at some point that it was not number one.
All right, going back to 2014, Problem, Ariana Grande featuring Iggy Azalea. It's a number two hit. It again feels like it's a number one hit, and it's actually Iggy keeping herself out of number one. Problem number two, her own Fancy, was number one.
You can only have one number one at a time, Iggy.
2012, Maroon 5 featuring Wiz Khalifa, Payphone. It's a number two hit, and I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily remember that One More Night, the follow-up, was a 9-week number one, but Payphone stopped at number two.
One thing I think definitely feels like a number one that was not is Taylor Swift's I Knew You Were Trouble. That song I remember was everywhere at the top of the year. And to me, it feels like that song was obviously I stand by that it's the most important record in Taylor's career because it was the first time that she really 100% broke from country.
Right.
You know, worked with Max Martin and Shellback for the first time. Had that song flopped, there may never have been a 1989.
Yeah.
May have never been a Reputation in the same way. But that song was such a monster on airplay. And I remember, you know, people always been, at least when I was in college, so a lot of people were really waiting on like a Taylor song they could just jam out to rather than something you kind of sing in your car that's a country song. And this was what they wanted. This is what they got. And this song was just, I mean, everywhere. And it really feels like, to me, it's aged better than the number one hit from that album, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together.
Oh, absolutely.
Feels a little, yeah. I don't know, almost a little campy in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun, it's sing along, but this really feels like just a song that dominates airwaves. People want to stream, people want to hear.
Maybe is one of the all-time examples at this point. Bad Romance, Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
Totally feels like a number one.
Yeah, I know a lot of people still to this day are probably surprised when you mention that it was there. And I mean, of course, it was trapped behind some big number ones at the time. Empire State of Mind was one of them. So obviously that song was massive everywhere too. But you're right. I mean, in the Gaga catalog, it feels like it should have got that number one.
And just so you know, some songs we're not mentioning. Some of these number two hits had just kind of a 1 week splash, maybe due to sales. Talking about another Taylor song, Today Was a Fairy Tale, 2010. It was just sort of a 1 week digital sales hit.
A few more I want to throw out there, just kind of some drive-by names. For sure, One Two Step by Ciara. I think a lot of people would remember that song fondly and remember that, you know, it came so close.
Looking at a few more from the 2000s, I'll add Boulevard of Broken Dreams by Green Day, Beautiful, Christina Aguilera, Complicated, Avril Lavigne, Hang By Moment, Lifehouse, all feel like number one hits. They got to number two, and interesting one in 2000, Breathe by Faith Hill, number two hit. but actually the number one song of that year on the Hot 100. Had just so many weeks high on the Hot 100 that when all the numbers were tabulated at the end, number two hit on the weekly chart was number one on the Hot 100. So a pretty good consolation prize.
I was going to say, I don't think she's going to be upset by hearing that. Baby, I just
All right, we won't go through the Hot 100's whole history, but just a few more from the 80s that stand out to me. Dancing in the Dark, Springsteen, first single from Born in the USA. It, in some ways, the most commercial song he's ever done. Got stuck behind When Doves Cry by Prince, so 4 weeks at number two. Right before that, Cyndi Lauper, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, number two hit. And then she'd hit number one after that with Time After Time.
And I got to give a shout out to Prince, actually, right after Dancing in the Dark. He has the next song to peak at number two,
right,
which is Purple Rain. And I think just given how iconic the album and the soundtrack have become, I think a lot of people would think that the title track would have been the biggest hit off of there. But Purple Rain had to settle for number two.
Well, a little tougher in some ways for Springsteen because Prince has had number one. Springsteen has never had a Hot 100 number one. So that was maybe his chance. Before that, a song that just it's sort of weird that the two of the biggest albums of the 80s, the first singles, both got to number two, not number one. Born in the USA, Dancing in the Dark, and Thriller, first single from Thriller, Girl Is Mine, Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney. That's also a number two hit.
I think when you ask people, though, like if that, you know, should be a number one hit, I think most people would probably say nah. I mean, if you had to rank the songs on Thriller, I don't know if that one ends up in the top half.
Right.
I mean, of course, after this, the next two singles, Billie Jean, Beat It, both become number ones, and that
just
feels...
Just the star power of Michael Jackson, Paul McCartney, first single. No one knew how big Thriller was going to be, obviously, at the time. It's more, a little bit more in retrospect that you look back, but kind of interesting, right? Two of the biggest albums of the 80s, lead singles, peaked to number two.
Yeah.
All right, got anything else from way before that, Trevor?
Well, I've got one that's a chart hit, but I think a couple things, too, that have aged so well in pop culture that it is so ubiquitous in a lot of ways, and everybody knows that you think it must have been a number one hit. Want to go right before the 80s. In 79, there are a couple songs that I think that have aged so well in the popular music canon. We Are Family by Sister Sledge. It's just one of those things, if you sing that hook to anybody, they're going to know it. They're going to sing along with it. It just feels like it must have been so big at the time,
right?
Which obviously being a number two hit, it was really big at the time, but not a number one. Unfortunately, blocked out at the top spot by the reigning queen of the era, Donna Summer,
yeah.
And Hot Stuff was number one at the time.
Legitimate number one. If you're going to not get to number one, that's a pretty good song to lose to.
I mean, Hot Stuff is also one of the songs that everyone would know that hook as well.
Right.
And two number twos, actually, before We Are Family, another kind of thing in that same vein, YMCA by the Village People. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, everyone's done that in gym class or at, you know, a sock hop or some school dance or whatever. And it feels like, how, you know, just like with the Macarena or some of these other huge dance moves, like how could YMCA, everybody knows it's so iconic, not have been a number one?
And what kept that from number one?
One of those 1-2 punches. At first, it was Chic's Le Freak. And then it was Rod Stewart's Do You Think I'm Sexy?
Yeah.
The first one, I'll give it, you know, people know, you know, Le Freak, people know that one. Do You Think I'm Sexy? I always kind of look back as like, it's a little odd number one.
A little novelty because it was Rod Stewart going disco, but it's a classic as well. It's a good time in the late 70s for some, all these songs that are stuck at number two behind hits that these are all lasting songs.
It's no YMCA, and that is the final word.
All right, that's the top 10 on the Hot 100 this week. Grammy Awards are Sunday night in New York City. Let's talk all about them. Let's find out who maybe is going to walk away with some of the biggest prizes, and who better for us to chat with than the founder of the Chartbeat column in Billboard. Again, back in 1981, wrote the column for more than a decade, still follows music, writes about music, and a huge fan of the Grammy Awards. Let's bring him in from our LA office. Paul Grine, our special guest on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast, talking all about the Grammys.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Come and move that in my direction. Thankful for that, it's such a blessing, yeah. Turn every situation into heaven, yeah. Oh, you are my sunrise on the darkest.
Paul Grind, thank you so much for coming back on the Billboard Sharpie podcast.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
We last time you were here was the very first episode ever.
Yeah.
So we got into your whole history of how the Chartbeat column started in Billboard. So the other thing that I know you're really a big fan of, Paul, is the Grammys. So we wanted to have you back on ahead of the Grammy Awards and go through a bunch of categories, get some of your picks for what you think might do well this year, and we'll give ours as well. I just wanted to ask you first, Paul, how'd you originally, obviously everyone, if you're a music fan, you get into the Grammys, but do you remember when you first really became a big fan? And not to date you, I'm sure mine.
I do remember. I got into music in 1971. Before that, I was probably less into it than most of my friends in junior high. I wasn't particularly into music. I was more into TV and sitcoms. And in 71, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And that was also, coincidentally, the first year of the live Grammy telecast. Yeah. So it just it came together. And the Grammys, I'm sure a lot of chart fans feel the same way. It's another fun universe with its own database and its own history and record setting. So if you're into one, you're probably into the other.
So for me, I don't know if there's a particular year where I really remember it first watching the Grammys. Trevor, you're a big Grammys fan too. Is there a specific moment for you?
No, I can't remember the first year. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's one of those things where you probably have it on in the house at some point, and you might, you know, your parents are watching it or whatever, so you kind of, you know, pay attention. I will say probably I think the first year I remember actively watching the Grammy Awards, probably start to finish, maybe was 2004, which of course
that recently.
Well, I'm a young gun.
You're a youngster. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was in middle school in 2004, and I remember.
I was in middle school. Oh
yeah.
Boy.
Yeah, I was, and I remember. Of course, the 2004 Grammys was a big one because it was the week right after the Super Bowl with Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake. So obviously.
Oh, yeah. That is a good first one.
Yes, yeah, so with Justin going to be there, it was, you know, much more controversial. Yes. People were much more interested. The bigger thing I remember that night was when Clocks by Coldplay won record of the year over Crazy in Love, and that to me was a very, yes, like, because obviously Crazy in Love was the much bigger hit. I remember it being a huge,
right,
obviously a Hot 100 number one, and it was a song that, you know, I mean, in middle school everyone, you know, knew it all. It was all the school dances, it was always on the radio, so it felt like it was the record of the year. And then I remember we were all like, who is Coldplay? What? Oh my god, the Grammys sucks, you know, that kind of thing. And so but, you know, that unpredictability about it is one of the things that I think for a lot of people makes it a lot more fun.
That year, there were several urban R&B records that were nominated for Record of the Year. Outkast's Hey Ya was also nominated, and they split the vote, whereas Coldplay you know, was the only record of its type that was nominated. So the pop and rock vote, which is huge in the Academy, coalesced behind one record. That often is the case, that you'll have vote splitting and the outlier can win.
Yeah.
I remember the first year I went in person was 1977. And it was the last time it was at the Palladium, which is, you know, a much smaller venue in Hollywood. Right. And it was also the last year Andy Williams hosted. And Barbra Streisand came out to present Record of the Year to George Benson for This Masquerade. And I remember thinking, I could get into this. To see Streisand, you know, not far from me, you know, walking on stage. What a great legend. And right. And it was very exciting. And I have held on to that sense of excitement ever since.
Have you been to a lot of Grammy Awards over the years?
I have over the years. In recent years, I've been watching from home because I'm writing at the same time and, you know, filing stories. But I've been to, quite a few.
Would you share which one you think is probably your favorite one, whether it was a record-setting night or something historic happened? Which one did you like the most?
Well, certainly the Thriller year was very exciting.
Oh, when you were there?
I was there.
Oh, wow.
The year he became the first artist to win 8 awards in one night. And in all these years since, it's only been, that record's only been tied once by Santana. I was there, too.
Well, maybe you're the good luck charm in the house.
I must be, yes.
Well, this year we're talking about rock and R&B. It feels like this year, maybe for the first time or at least in a while, the Grammys are seeming to be catching up more on R&B and hip-hop. There's been, obviously, that's been a big narrative in recent years that hasn't gotten its due with the Grammys. And feels like this year, at least from the nominees, that much more inclusive this year.
Were you surprised by those nominations when they came out, Paul?
Yes. All year long, I thought it would be a showdown between Ed Sheeran and Kendrick Lamar in the top three categories. In the same way that a year ago, it was a showdown between Adele and Beyonce. And I think it's possible that the nominations committee, the nominations review committee, which makes the final determinations in the top four categories, saw the writing on the wall and saw the possibility of Ed Sheeran sweeping this year, and another round of stories about how the Grammys always favor mainstream pop over hip-hop and R&B, and didn't want that to happen again, so they just didn't nominate him in any of the top three categories, which I was shocked by. Certainly, I thought Shape of You deserved a nomination for Record of the Year, not just because it was a giant hit, you know, that isn't the whole story, that isn't what the Grammys are supposed to be about, but it was a departure for him, for somebody who made his name on ballads, and here he did something completely different and very convincingly, and I thought it deserved a slot for Record of the Year. I understand what I believe they tried to do, which was not give the voters those pure pop options, and it'll be interesting to see what they're maneuvering results in terms of awards, because they have Jay-Z and Kendrick Lamar up for both record and album of the year. Childish Gambino is also up for those two awards and could further take some votes away from fans of you know, R&B and contemporary hip-hop. So we could wind up with a situation where they split the vote, where if only one of them, say Kendrick, had been nominated, he might have done better than when he's splitting his votes with Jay-Z, who I think, you know, to a certain extent appeal to the same constituency.
Yeah, let's go through the major categories, Paul, and then we'll go into some other ones and get your picks. We'll give ours for the big four categories, and we're just starting to talk about this. For Record of the Year, we'll start with Record of the Year. So the five nominated are Redbone, Childish Gambino, Despacito, Luis Fonsi, Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber, Story of O.J., Jay-Z, Humble, Kendrick Lamar, and 24 Karat Magic, Bruno Mars. What's your pick, Paul?
I think it'll be Despacito. Not just because it was a giant hit, 16 weeks at number one, but also it was a very influential record in reopening the door for Latin pop and really making several other, you know, Latin pop records have been hits in its wake, and kind of making that hopefully a permanent part of the top 40 landscape. It should have been all along. And also, I think the fact that you have two artists from Puerto Rico and one from Canada singing a bilingual song, mostly in Spanish, some in English, will speak to a lot of voters in the Donald Trump era as a sign of, you know, different types of people working together and getting along. And I think that kind of, if only on a subconscious level, that dynamic will be playing in a lot of voters' minds. Yeah,
yeah, that's my pick too for what should win. Yeah, we've seen on the charts, you know, to tie the Grammys to the charts. We've sort of dubbed it internally the Despacito effect. When we've seen Camila Cabello Havana become such a big hit, we feel like
wonderful record.
Yeah, right. It may be Despacito opened doors for that. We're seeing Debbie Lovato on the Latin chart, Cardi B with Ozuna singing in Spanish. So it seems like very quickly, and usually these kind of trends take a little bit longer. But you know, era now where you can put out a song more easily on streaming or digitally. You can put out a song pretty quickly, and it can reflect those kinds of trends. So, yeah, I just feel like the overall pop culture impact that Despacito made, totally fitting for Record of the Year. Trevor, is it unanimous pick among the three of us?
It is. Yeah, I mean, I think for all those reasons that Paul noted, you know, just in terms of the cultural moment, and that it's actually not just a one-off thing, that we've seen the effects of it, but. And I know Paul kind of downplayed the hit factor a little bit, but I mean, it does help in Record of the Year to, you know, be a huge song. I mean, the past, you know, winners of this song have all either been number one hits or number two hits on the Hot 100, you know, basically this entire decade. I mean, last year was Adele's Hello. The year before we had Uptown Funk. The year before that was Sam Smith, Stay With Me, Get Lucky, Daft Punk, Pharrell, Gautier, going way back to Somebody That I Used to Know, Rolling in the Deep before that. So, I mean, all these songs, massive hits. Everyone knows them very well. So that definitely plays into it. And, I mean, Despacito, by far, the biggest hit of the crowd.
16 weeks at number one doesn't guarantee that Despacito will win Record of the Year. The last record before it to have 16 weeks at number one was One Sweet Day, which was nominated but didn't win. Being a big hit is helpful. But it, our listeners should probably understand that it's not a guarantee. They occasionally, as with Clocks, when that won, U2's Walk On, there are things where if you're expecting just big hits to win, occasionally you'll be surprised.
Can you listen to Clocks at this point, Trevor, or does it just make you sad when you hear Clocks? Does it
bring back bad memories? I don't care that badly. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure maybe Beyonce can't stand the song, but you know, live and let go.
Well, they recorded him for the weekend together, so I think she's probably
right.
Okay with it.
Maybe there is something there.
All right, I was the presenter on stage for Record of the Year. Trevor, come out and announce the nominees for Album of the Year.
Oh, okay. Oh, the biggest prize of the night goes to me. All right. So Album of the Year, a lot of the same names that we saw on Record of the Year will be up for this prize too. Awaken My Love, Childish Gambino. We've got 444 by Jay-Z. Damn by Kendrick Lamar. Melodrama for Lorde, holding it down for the pop fans. And 24 Karat Magic, Bruno Mars. Good slate of nominees. Paul, what is your pick for who's going to take the biggest statue of them all, Album of the Year?
Well, I think Bruno Mars will win for 24 Karat Magic. I think if only Kendrick Lamar or Jay-Z had been nominated, either of them might have had a much better chance. But with both of them nominated, evenly, two very evenly matched rap nominees, it's tough. This is the fourth time that two rap albums have been nominated in the same year. Only once has one of them won when there were two nominated in the same year, and that was when OutKast beat Missy Elliott. But I think OutKast was clearly the chief rap album that year. This year, I don't think either one of these has a commanding edge over the other. Jay-Z has one more nomination than Kendrick, even though I think Kendrick has the critical support and the sense that, you know, it's his time, it's his moment. So to me, it's kind of a muddled picture as to which of them would win. And I think that clears an opening for something else. It reminds me of 1984 when Lionel Richie's Can't Slow Down beat Springsteen's Born in the USA and Prince's Purple Rain. And I remember thinking at the time that I don't think there are enough rock fans who are young and kind of progressive for one of them to win when they're two splitting the vote right down the middle. And I think that allowed Lionel to come in, scooping up all the pop fans, R&B fans, you know, people who like more, melodic top 40 music. And in a similar way, I think Bruno can benefit from the vote splitting between Jay-Z and Kendrick Lamar.
Now, I know a lot of people also, I mean, a lot of the critics list, at least at the end of last year, surprisingly had Lord as their favorite album or the number two album. I saw a lot of Lord and Kendrick ties. And interestingly about Lord is this is her only nomination this year. So, I mean.
Yes, that was amazing for your only nomination to be for album of the year. I think it has a chance. I think it has a fairly good chance as a long shot behind Bruno Mars. It would be the first time in Grammy history that an album has been passed over for a nomination in its genre album category, which in her case is pop vocal album, wasn't nominated by the voters in that category. It would be the first time that an album that was passed over for that genre award has won album of the year if it wins. So that's why I say it's a long shot. But it's, you know, she's the only woman in the finals. Yeah. She's the only pop album. A lot of people would call Bruno Mars a pop album, though it's slotted in R&B here. Jack Antonoff, who's a big Grammy favorite, co-produced it. So there are a lot of strengths there.
Do you think, I mean, obviously given out what happened 2 years ago when Taylor Swift beat Kendrick Lamar, a lot of people had an issue with that. Last year we saw Adele top Beyonce. Do you think the Grammy sort of organization or committee would be kind of nervous that, you know, four other R&B hip hop albums, one pop album, and somehow the pop album takes the prize? I mean, that'll be a little bit of a PR fiasco.
Well, I have to believe that the Grammy organization would like these stories to be put to rest. And, the way for that to happen would be if one of these years, one of them wins. Now, there have been two hip-hop albums that have won Album of the Year. The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. It was slotted in the R&B category in the Grammys, but it's hip-hop. And then the OutKast album. But that's only two, and as big as hip-hop has been over the last 30, 40 years now, it's probably due for another one.
We mentioned Childish Gambino is up for Album of the Year, Record of the Year. We haven't really, I feel like we almost bypassed that. Does he have a chance? I feel like he's got a lot of critical acclaim just for his different sides of acting and music, or do we think, nope. Doesn't have a chance.
He'll definitely win for best traditional R&B vocal, best traditional R&B performance. So he will not go home empty-handed. And to win two Emmys and at least one, maybe more, Grammys in the same year is pretty good. Right. I don't think he has a chance for album. I think progressive fans would rather see one of the rap albums win. And more traditional, older fans would rather see either Bruno or Lord win. So I don't see a path to victory for him for album. I was surprised he was nominated for album. But it's possible that Redbone will win Record of the Year. It's a great record. Just a really excellent very well arranged record. It should have been nominated for a Grammy for Best Arrangement. I always think every time I hear it, boy, that's well arranged. But I don't think it's going to win. I think it'll be Despacito. I'm glad he was nominated, though.
So for Album of the Year, Paul, you're picking 24 Karat Magic. I something just in my head is telling me that this is Kendrick's year. I just kind of feel like overall impact, could be the one that wins.
It could be. It could be his year. It's his third Album of the Year nomination. Doesn't mean he has to win because it's his third. Beyonce's had three, and she lost on her third, as we all know, last year. I just have a hard time seeing him win when there's another very strong rap album in the finals, pulling votes away from him. People who think Jay-Z will win Album of the Year and that voters will somehow flip and give it to Kendrick for Best Rap Album, which is possible. It's a year where it could go several different ways. I don't see Childish Gambino winning album, but the other four, there are scenarios where you can, see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Jay-Z thing is so interesting too, because I know a lot of people, maybe did not expect this nomination. The album necessarily, while it, did cause some waves, wasn't necessarily a blockbuster in the way that the Kendrick album was, but now that Jay-Z's obviously in the conversation, you look at his pioneering efforts in terms of, just what he's done for hip hop and bringing it, as one of the biggest heavyweights of the past couple decades, bringing it to worldwide attention, getting inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, as the first rapper. A lot of people think that obviously while Kendrick may be due for an award based on, what he's done in the past couple of years, I know there's a big sentiment that feels like, Jay-Z in terms of his entire career arc deserve something too, and we've seen some of these shows give out these sort of career capping honors. Sometimes the biggest prizes can go to people decades after people think they really deserve their first notice.
Sure, Steely Dan won in 2000. A lot of people thought that was kind of a career award for Asia and Gaucho and all the things they had done years before. Beck a few years ago was some kind of a career award. It wasn't just for that album. It was, here's somebody who's been doing quality work for 20 years. Here's a chance to give him Album of the Year. Let's take it. And Jay-Z, there might be people who vote for him as a kind of a makeup to Beyonce for having lost last year. A lot of people thought she could have won last year or should have won last year. Adele could have taken record and song for Hello, which she did, but there's a sense that she need all three. So that could play into Jay-Z's favor, as well as the idea of this album shows that a rapper can address middle-aged themes in the hip-hop format. So that's a pioneering thing that he's doing. So as I say, you can make a pretty good argument for about four of these albums. I think I'm still going to stay with Bruno.
Right, so you've got Bruno. I guess I'm picking Kendrick, although I could totally see Bruno as well. Trevor, put yours on the record.
I feel like Kendrick is my pick. I will say that, I don't know. I still leave a little bit of room for Lorde. I think also with Finesse, though, being a big hit at this time, I'm not sure when ballots are due, but that definitely has revived interest in Bruno's album, so people may be giving it a new listen.
Ballots were due December 21st. That's another issue. I don't understand why the Grammys take 5 weeks to count the votes. Between December 21st...
Before Christmas,
The voting closed on December 21st, and the winners will be announced January 28th. So, it's tempting to look at what's happening in January. Hits, Bruno has another smash hit from his album. You could say could Finesse, push him over the top. The voting was done, a few weeks ago. So I would like to see them get close the voting much closer to the announcement of the awards. The Oscar votes are due 5 days before the Oscar telecast.
Yeah.
And I think that's I think that's a good way to do it. And I don't understand why they need 5 weeks to count the votes. Somebody, you know, if they're doing it by hand, somebody needs to find an accounting firm that has a computer.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe the fact there are so many categories, but even still, I mean, you should be able to knock that out in a day.
Just it would make the voting more current, and the voting would be fresher, and voters could respond to late-breaking developments. Right now, it's frozen in place for 5 weeks.
All right, we talked a lot about Bruno Mars, Jay-Z. They'll be having a showdown one more time in the Song of the Year category. So they're actually up for the Triple Crown that Adele took home last year. Gary, if you want to run us down, what are the songs that are going to be up for the Songwriters Award that is Song of the Year?
Ooh, I get to say, and the nominees are Despacito, 444, Issues, recorded by Julia Michaels, 1-800-273-8255, recorded by Logic, and That's What I Like by Bruno Mars.
I'm sticking with Despacito for both record and song. They don't always go hand in hand, but fairly often they do. I think it's between Despacito and 1-800. Despacito will, if it wins, be the first song that's mostly in a foreign language to win Song of the Year since Volare, way back at the first awards in 1958. That was, of course, in Italian. This is mostly in Spanish.
Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel blu, dipinto di blu.
The only one that I think has a shot at upsetting it is 1-800, because everyone admires what they did on that song. It's a very, you know, a good song in its own right, but the fact that they managed to put across to a young radio listening audience a message about suicide prevention and being conscious of friends who might be going through a hard time, I just think it's tremendous what they did. And on top of it being a great song, that could give it to that. It would be the first song with a social message to win since Eric Clapton's Changed the World 21 years ago.
Yeah, we talk about this being a songwriter's award, and I think you always sort of equate that being it has to be serious. But yeah, songwriting still means you wrote Despacito. You still have to write it. Even the lyrics maybe aren't as deep as 1-800. It's still a fun song. Everyone loves it. So given the impact it had, I totally could see Despacito winning. I feel like I'm leaning more towards 1-800 just for, as you mentioned, Paul, the message, the importance, and to have made it a connect like that. Pretty amazing that he was able to make that message musically sound like another pop song while at the same time saying something so important.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. They made that phone number as famous, as familiar to, you know, young radio listeners as the number of their local Domino's. And that's a great achievement. If Despacito wins, it'll set a record for not only the first foreign language song since Volare, but the song with the most songwriters to win. There's six songwriters on that song. It also set a record if That's What I Like wins, that has eight songwriters, and if Issues wins, that has five.
Yeah.
So if any of those three wins this year, it'll break the current record, which is four songwriters. And of course, until the year 2000, there was none that were even four. You know, back in the day, one person wrote a song, or maybe two. And now we're up to committees of, you know, five, six, and eight writers. It's a big change.
Yeah, we've talked about that a lot, Paul, on the podcast, that exact trend. It used to be about half the Hot 100 every week. It was written by one person, and now there's maybe one or two songs a week. And we've asked different people about this. It sort of seems that it's a combination of just music. Songwriting has become more collaborative over the years, but also contracts are more sophisticated at this point, where in the past, someone might have contributed some lines and just didn't get credit. Now, if you have a certain beat, even as a producer, you can be a songwriter. So it kind of sounds like those are the two main angles to why that's happened.
Right. It's interesting that now it's even impacting the Grammy Song of the Year nominees.
Right. I wonder, I think there's probably people who are wondering, the fact songs in a foreign language, will that, you know, inhibit people from either fully understanding it or comprehending it. For, you know, a songwriter's award, they're going to look at the lyrics. Most people probably don't speak Spanish, you know, who would be voting for this award. Do you think that, you know, I mean, I see you still picked it, obviously, but you don't think that'll downplay its chances at all?
It could. If 1-800 wins, then we'll say, well, there you go. But I think the fact that it, the bilingual aspect in this year might work in its favor. The melding of pop and Latin, of people of different backgrounds and bridging genres and nationalities, I think that might speak to a current need. And while it's close and I could see it going either way, I think I'll stick with Despacito.
I like it.
What's your pick, Trevor?
I personally lean towards 1-800 just because I think when people look at the ballot, I mean, it'll be kind of like maybe not even voting so much for it as if, like, how could you vote against it? I mean, I do think,
that's well said.
I mean, I do think, you know, given the social climate that it comes in, I mean, obviously, helps out a lot. And even, not that it's going to be a political jab per se, but I think that just the message and the timing is right. And I think, you know, maybe down the line, we'll look at something different and say, maybe, you know, it was helped by this moment and maybe it should have been a different song. But I think, you know, you only can vote in the moment. And literally, this is a good year for that. I mean, even with things like 13 Reasons Why on Netflix, I mean, you know, suicide prevention, bullying, you know, anxiety. I mean, so many teen problems have come to the forefront, and I think voters will hopefully recognize that.
We are the world one. That's what friends are for. Streets of Philadelphia, as I said, change the world. So there's a precedent for songs that take on social messages to win here.
All right, the other major category is Best New Artist. The nominees are Alessia Cara, Khalid, Lil Uzi Vert, Julia Michaels, and SZA. Paul, give us your take.
This one is tough. I think this is the hardest of the big four. I think SZA will take it. Alessia Cara obviously had three top 10 hits during the year.
Do you think for Alessia it's odd that I know people were expecting her to be nominated last year, but the fact that she was sort of delayed a year, I mean, I wonder if that could either help her or
hurt her. It's very odd to me. When Here was a top 5 hit 2 years ago, it would seem to me that that constitutes prominence, and that was the year she exploded. I think that probably fell into last year's a year ago's Grammy year, but they try to have some flexibility in the Best New Artist category and have a longer window than they're able to in the other three, you know, album, record, and song categories. It used to be they were very tight, and Whitney Houston wasn't allowed to compete because she had recorded a duet with Teddy Pendergrass, you know, and Richard Marx wasn't allowed to compete. He had one track on a soundtrack, and it wasn't even a hit soundtrack. It was the soundtrack to Nothing in Common.
Yeah, I actually know that song.
A Tom Hanks movie.
Burning of the Heart. I actually know that song.
Very good, Gary.
Yeah.
You're the one who knows it. So they used to be too restrictive and knock people out too easily and freely. And now they, probably go a little far in the other direction, trying to include people. I'm glad for Alessia. I think she's a great singer. But, you know, that's a stretch to say that this was her first year.
I know people want to attribute sort of these new rules, they call it like maybe the Gaga rule, or more recently the Meghan Trainor rule, which people thought was kind of odd that All About That Bass was up for Record of the Year,
yes,
and Song of the Year.
And Song of the Year.
a year before she was up for Best New Artist. So it's kind of like, you know, she could have won Record of the Year and then next year been the Best New Artist, which I thought, you know, kind of throws us a whack. And hopefully...
No, if she had won a Grammy, once you win a Grammy, you're not allowed to compete.
Oh, interesting.
In fact, once you're... Nowadays, they keep changing the rules for Best New Artist. Now, once you're nominated in your own right, you're not allowed to compete. The reason that Megan was allowed in the year after is they waited for her first full-length album. And I think she'd had some indie albums, but her first full-length album with national distribution. And that came out the year after All About That Bass. So it gets confusing. Best New Artist is certainly the most complicated category, even for the Academy. They labor over this and try and get it right. And it's very hard to, you know, whatever decision you make, you're going to impact somebody else, and you know, no matter what you do, you're not going to please everybody. So they're up against that in this category. I do think the five people that they got, that they nominated this year, are very strong. It's a good field, and even some of the people who didn't make it, Logic didn't make it, and he was eligible this year, even though it was his third album. It's odd that Khalid and Alessia Cara, who were featured on Logic's hit, are up for this, and Logic isn't. But that's, he was just squeezed out. You know, five slots fill up pretty fast.
Yeah, I guess Uzi Vert probably taking the rap slot, if you want to call it that, in this category. But of these five, who do you think ends up walking away with it? Which I think this is one of my favorite category, because it's the only Grammy Award you can win. Like, you could only get one time on your first time. That's the only time you can get it. So, in any case, of these five, Paul, who's your pick for Best New Artist?
I think SZA, on the strength of the critical acclaim she's gotten. Last year, Chance the Rapper beat the Chainsmokers and Maren Morris. And he also had a similar, you know, amount of critical heat behind him. I think that that might help. Obviously, Alessia is so strong, so that wouldn't surprise me, but I think SZA.
Trevor?
Yeah, I could see SZA as well. I mean, I'm worried if she and Khalid could split maybe some R&B votes. I know SZA is the most nominated woman of the night, so I think people, maybe with five nominations, will at least, you know, be checking her music out if you hadn't known who she was before or have checked it out since the voting is closed. But yeah, I mean, I do wonder if, I mean, you know, Julia Michaels really only one song, not a whole lot to back it up yet. So maybe a little too early for most people.
Even if she doesn't win, that's a great validation of going from a songwriter to being an artist and immediately being nominated for Best New Artist. That's, I feel like it's almost a win in its own right.
Yes. No, it was a win for her to be nominated when she only had one hit. You know, she was borderline and she got in there. So that is the win.
Yeah. And
a great hit, but only one hit. You know, if she had followed issues with, you know, another hit or two, she might be the front runner.
I think SZA.
Yeah.
I do like her chances. And I think, I just think, especially maybe, I mean, helping with the Top Dog connection, Kendrick, obviously, one of the big players of the night. I just think that. And even with the new song, well, again, the new song doesn't matter because the voting's closed. But I'm still going SZA.
I feel like Alessia Cara could benefit from having been out so long and been on a bunch of hits. Maybe in a category where maybe there isn't a whole bunch of separation. Maybe that is what sets her apart. But critically, something is drawing me to Khalid. I feel like he could be a very deserving winner just because we've heard a lot of different sides of him. We've heard him on the Logic song, on Marshmallow. Mm-hmm. He's doing a really interesting
to be fair,
melody.
Cara has that. I mean, she's got the Zed connection.
Yeah, true.
And she's got, yeah.
I mean. But then he's singing on Young, Dumb, and Broke, which I think is a really, it's a really melodic song. It just kind of feels like he's bringing elements of old school R&B with a
Young, Dumb is a good example.
Yeah.
Of a record that broke a little bit after the close of voting. At least my sense is I'm hearing it on the radio a lot more in the last few weeks. If the voting was closer to the awards, you know, people might, it would have helped him because he, it would have been a second big hit in his own right as a lead artist, and a totally different sound and type of song than Location. But the record was still kind of building when voting closed.
I would be okay with a tie in this category. I think
five-way tie.
There's so much talent and so many, I mean, just people doing just great. I mean, just talent and interesting things and new sounds. I mean, it's really hard to.
That would be kind of fun. There's only ever been one tie in the big four categories. And that was in 77 when Evergreen and You Light Up My Life tied for Song of the Year. But it would be exciting, you know, and 40 years later, we're due for another tie.
Although my heart is falling too, I'm in love with your body. And last night you were in my room, and now my bedsheets smell like you. Every day discovering something.
All right, well, those are the four big categories for this year. We mentioned at the beginning how Ed Sheeran sort of seems like he may have been snubbed a little bit in the major categories.
Gary, you have to downplay it so much. A lot of people believe that, yeah. That Ed Sheeran somehow is missing.
I think he deserved, at least Record of the Year for Shape of You. He was punished because of the Grammys' history of favoring, you know, mainstream pop over contemporary R&B and hip hop, and before that, you know, 30 years ago, for favoring mainstream pop over rock. But it's not his fault, and to take it out on him when he had nothing to do with it, seemed unfair to me.
Someone who's not up for Record of the Song of the Year, maybe similar kind of a sound, Sam Smith, especially when you think of the vocals, Too Good Goodbyes. That's an amazing vocal, and I don't know, is that a snub as well?
Yes. I was surprised. I it's a wonderful record and song, and I thought it would be up for both awards. He stayed in his same comfort zone rather than, you know, moving out of it and showing another side of him. And, you know, that if that argument was made in the committee, you know, there is some logic to that. There is, that makes some sense. But it's a great song and record, and I expected it to be nominated. And if they are so fond of artists showing another side of them and you know, venturing into another style and moving on, then, you know, Ed did that, you know, wonderfully on Shape of You. So one thing I will say in the defense of the committee is it is almost impossible to narrow it down to five. In fact, it is impossible.
Right.
I've been playing the nominees CD, which came out last week, and there are 21 tracks. They're obviously all very good tracks. You don't get to that level of success, and you know, without, you know, being lousy. They're all good, and I would urge your listeners to pretend they are committee members and listen to the 21 tracks and decide which five they would put up for Record of the Year. And it's hard. I Feel It Still didn't make it for any of the big awards. It's a wonderful record. There, you know, virtually all 21 of these could have been up in the major categories. And, you know, it's very difficult to narrow it down to five.
One last question, Paul. Do you think, in terms of Ed and in terms of Sam, that is there any sort of precedent in some way that being a previous winner maybe hurts you in terms of getting those next set of nominations? Sam Smith obviously won Best New Artist, Song of the Year, Record of the Year, when Stay With Me came out. Do you think that...
Not a clear pattern. You know, Adele obviously followed an album that swept the big three with another album that swept the big three. Taylor... Right. You know, one album of the year before that, even though she had won before. I would guess that going forward, the committee will be more careful about putting somebody up. It might be a difficult thing for Taylor to be nominated for album of the year next year, because they may say, gee, if we nominate her, the voters will vote for her, and that would be her third Album of the Year winner. So we may see the committee continue to try and kind of outsmart the voters and
spread the wealth,
direct the voters. Yeah.
I'll ask one more question, Paul. I guess it sort of maybe fits in the snub category, but big year, certainly at pop radio for all the One Direction guys. Number one hits for Niall. Zayn had another big hit with Taylor Swift, Liam as well. Harry Styles, Sign of the Times, did okay. Didn't do as well as the others, but it seems like it maybe got more critical acclaim because he put out an album that was sort of reminiscent of 70s glam rock in places. Do solo members from boy bands over the years, is that just always considered not quite Grammy levels? It considered a little too bubblegum for the Grammys?
I guess. I think the Grammys were wrong on. I think the 1D guys made great records this year. A Sign of the Times, I think, is a work of art, and I thought it would be up for Record of the Year, and it wasn't. I don't think it's up for anything, even pop vocal, which is like a very competitive category. But I thought it showed a lot of ambition. And Niall Slohan, it is also a great record. It's not as maybe groundbreaking as Sign of the Times was, but it's a really nice record. I think they probably did suffer from coming from One Direction, which was never nominated for a Grammy in any category: Best New Artist, Best Pop Album, Best Pop Duo Group, anything. Which is kind of amazing when you think of the number of hits they had and how successful they were. Artists can overcome coming out of boy bands. George Michael won Album of the Year for Faith.
Right.
Justin Timberlake has been nominated for Album of the Year twice with his first two albums. Hasn't won yet. So in those cases, their growth was recognized, and their maybe bubblegummy beginnings worked in their favor when people saw how they'd matured. For some reason, Styles' record didn't get that recognition this year.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much. Your insights are just so valuable for having followed the Grammy Awards for many years. And as the founder of Billboard's Chartbeat column, the podcast is named after Chartbeat, for what you came up with when you started it in 1981. So thank you so much, Paul, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Trevor.
All right. Thanks. Hey, we'll be keeping score, so make sure we tune in.
Okay.
we'll see if Bruno, Double Despacito, and SZA bring it home.
There you go.
Well, thanks to Paul for his predictions out there. Feeling like it's going to be a little even spread. No Adele triple crown sweep for anybody out there. But we're interesting to see. I mean, obviously we saw with the nominees this year, such a slate that really people were probably not expecting, and certainly a lot more, R&B, hip hop, urban driven. So we'll see what happens when it comes to the actual winners this time and see if there's any milestones there.
Yeah, we got so deep into the four major categories and a little bit more, but so many other categories we could talk about. I want to mention a couple real quick that maybe just a little more niched, but are sort of interesting for their own reasons.
Yeah, and going off how we see so much at the top with those big four categories being, a lot of competition between people in the same genre, I'm interested to see how that kind of bleeds down into those respective genre categories. One of the things that I'm kind of keeping an eye out on is Best Urban Contemporary Album, which I think will be interesting. Beyonce won that last year for Lemonade. This year, I mean, there's a good mix of nominees in there. You got Free Black by Black. You have Awaken My Love by Childish Gambino, which we know is up for Album of the Year. You've got American Teen by Khalid, who's up for Best New Artist. Control SZA, who's also up for Best New Artist. And then you've got Starboy by The Weeknd. And we know The Weeknd has taken home a few Grammys in the past as well, so you can never count him out. I mean, it feels like, I guess most people would say that because Childish is up for Album of the Year, that that probably gives him the lock in that category. But I'm not sure. I mean, with Khalid and with SZA in there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, SZA is the most nominated woman of the night with 5 awards, and people obviously, you know, really feeling her. I'm interested to see where that goes, because it feels like it could go a lot of ways. And also, you know, sometimes maybe people like to use some of these quote-unquote lesser categories to highlight people who will not be necessarily highlighted in the upper categories. So maybe that's where a SZA, maybe where Khalid gets a pickup if they don't think that person is going to win Best New Artist. So that for me is one of the ones that I'm really interested in watching.
All right, I'm going way deeper. Best folk album, because I manage the Americana folk.
Okay,
chart.
That's definitely going to be the pre-show.
the Amy Mann is up for Mental Illness, which she will tell you is one of her happier titles. For her, that's a happy title. But really good album. She's 30 years into her career, more than that. Former lead singer of Till Tuesday had a top 10 hit in 1985 on the Hot 100 Voices Carry. But she's become a little bit more of a folk singer-songwriter type artist in recent years. And just a great album. Here's a little piece of one of the songs.
Gotta keep it together when your friends come back. Always checking the weather, but they wanna know why. Even birds of a feather find it hard to fly.
What else are we flashing back to this week, Trevor, to wrap things up?
While we're talking about Grammys, we are going to take it back to 1973. This week in Billboard chart history, one of the all-time great Grammy runs began with a song that went to number one. We're talking about the one, the only, the legendary, you can hear it now. Superstition by Stevie Wonder, which hit number one this week on Hot 100 in 1973. You take that song from New York, you can take it down to the Argentina, you can take it to the Australian outback, up to Japan, wherever. You play it on that little clavinet, and people are going to know that song. They're going to know that. How amazing to have a song that literally probably everybody who's even heard pop music would know.
I guess part of the key is to have an instrument that most people aren't going to have anyway. Not too many people have a clavinet, I'm assuming.
Probably not. And I mean, it just, you know, in your early 20s to have that intuition. This was the first single off his Talking Book album, which a lot of people really consider the beginning of what many refer to as the golden period, the golden years of Stevie's career in the 70s, when so many classic albums. Obviously, we've got Talking Book here. We're going to have Fulfillingness's first finale coming up, and then really bringing it home with Songs in the Key of Life. And when we talk about the Grammys in particular, this is a period where between 1974, when he was nominated for Superstition and some of the work off Talking Book, through 1977, Stevie wins 12 Grammy Awards, including a trifecta of Albums of the Year. 3 Albums of the Year in a 4-year period. And perhaps they say the only reason that he did not win all 4 years is because in the year that he did not win, he did not put out an album.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if that could ever happen again, because people just don't release music as frequently, at least full albums like they did back then. That may never happen again.
And forget about putting out an album. I mean, to put out, that's all good quality music. I mean, right. No one can, you know, argue that, oh, Stevie just won because he's Stevie or whatever. I mean, those albums all stand the test of time. My favorite anecdote, though, in that period is when Stevie won it for 2 consecutive years, missed out on the 3rd year, and then won it the 4th year. In that year in between, Paul Simon won the Album of the Year Grammy, and the last person he thanked was Stevie Wonder for not putting out an album that year. Everyone just knew how talented Stevie was at the time, and of course how much he was sweeping up that winner's circle. And funny enough, one of the things that I find most sort of endearing about this whole thing that started off with Superstition is three times winning Album of the Year in that category. There was a Grammy special a few weeks back on CBS where they documented for the 60th anniversary a lot of big moments and a lot of, you know, talked to a lot of celebrities and their impressions and everything. Stevie was one of the people they spoke with, mentioning this three times, getting the Album of the Year in that short span and how historic that was. And he said, you know, of course he's very happy, very proud, has 25 Grammys overall to his name, but said that he still always wishes he could win the Best Song of the Year Grammy.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that he would still like to have. And I thought, yeah, I mean, how, you know, for a guy who's three Album of the Years, sitting there, 25 trophies back home, you know, he's still got a goal out there. Still has something that he hasn't achieved that he wants to. And I thought that was just so cool and so endearing that, you know, that's one of the things that might keep him going. And to wrap us up, 4 years later, same week, Stevie's collecting another number one. So here we are in another Grammy Award-winning composition by Stevie Wonder from the Songs in the Key of Life album. This is I Wish.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.